Today we're continuing our series called The Gift of Hard Things. And we're using some of the framework of some of the issues in Mark Iaconelli's book by the same title. And I'm with Renee when she says that the title of this series made her wince. I don't like hard things, particularly the topics that we're dealing with, but they're all realities of life. And so, as people of faith, we need to ask how God's word leads us to address these issues. And so, often when facing these things, it's tempting to be dismissive or try to look on the bright side. But that's not what this series is about. It's about God taking our difficulties in these issues and somehow transforming them for good, bringing good out of it. And in the introduction to his book, Iaconelli states that his book isn't actually about presenting a formula for transforming difficulty into spiritual freedom, because that's something only God can accomplish. But rather, what he says is, he still, at the same time, recognizes that in the wake of suffering, we need help calibrating our lives back to what he calls our compassionate and God-trusting selves. And as Christians, we have a hope that God can bring good out of even these difficult issues. Romans 8:28 has a tremendous promise that we can lean on. It says, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Now, this is more than just what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. This is a belief that God is going to actively move even in our difficulties and somehow transform them for good. And so that's what we're trying to do again today, is orient ourselves to that promise and bring it back into focus. So in the first week, we looked at difficult people. Last week, we looked at disappointment. And today, we're going to talk about loss. And loss is one of those big and scary concepts that can come in any number of ways or degrees. But everybody experiences loss. I recently saw a video clip of Oprah interviewing Stephen Colbert a few years ago. And this was while I think he still had a show on Comedy Central before he was the host of The Late Show, which he is now. And they're both of these people, they're known for their success in television, but they're also two people who have suffered huge loss. And they discussed how Colbert, who is the youngest of 11 children, suffered the loss of his father and two brothers, the two brothers closest to him in age, to a plane crash when he was just 10 years old. And that left him as the only remaining child in his mother's house because all the other children had already moved out. And he talked about how hard it was to process and how sad it made him, but it's weird. In the interview, they go from that and then immediately transition to how he refers to his show as the Joy Machine. And how on his computer is a quote from a friend that says, "Joy is the most infallible sign of the existence of God." And in a separate interview, he actually stated that part of learning to come to terms with the tragedy he experienced in his life is actually what made him the joyful performer that he is today. And then on the other side of this interview, we have Oprah, who's no stranger to loss herself. She's a survivor of sexual abuse by multiple family members in childhood. And at 14, she gave birth to a son who was premature and died a week later. And even after she got older and got her break in television, she became a news anchor, but then got demoted from that job, in part because she was too emotionally engaged to the stories that she was covering. And yet that emotional engagement then became the hallmark of her hit talk show, if you ever watched it. If there's anyone who's emotionally engaged, it's Oprah. But that was just the beginning of what's now her media empire. And yet both of these remarkably successful people who have experienced great loss were able to sit and casually talk about joy of all things. And it seems to suggest that loss can be transformed for good, but it also begs the question of whether that's something extraordinary that only happens for famous people, or whether it can happen for anybody. And we usually think of loss as death, and that's certainly true, but we'll look at death specifically in the upcoming weeks, but loss takes many forms. And so what I want us to do before we plunge into the text is take a moment and think about your losses. If you're taking notes, maybe take a second and jot them down. We experience all kinds of losses, and it might be the loss of a job, whether it was whether you were involuntarily let go, or whether even you chose to retire. It might be the loss of certain physical abilities, either to an accident or old age. We might lose our home or our community for something as simple as moving for work, or something as tragic as a natural disaster, or for many people in the world, even war or persecution. We might lose a relationship or a marriage to divorce, maybe for just difficulties that couldn't be worked out, or even for reasons of betrayal. And we might lose things we never even had. We might lose dreams that we grew up with and then see the door close on them and have to come to terms with the fact that we'll never see them come to fruition. Loss comes in a lot of shapes and sizes, but today we're going to look at a book that takes us as readers and it throws us right into the middle of a tragic situation, a story of tragic loss. And it shows how God can work to redeem it, even in the lives of ordinary people. And so we're going to be looking at the book of Ruth. And Ruth is a beautifully written short story in the Old Testament. It's only 4 chapters long. You could probably read it on your coffee break, and I encourage you to do so. Because it's one of those books, it's short, but it's got these robust theological themes woven into it, and yet at the same time it's just 4 short chapters. And so we're only going to be able to scratch the surface of it all, but it still has a lot to tell us about facing loss. And so as we look at this story, we're going to look at not so much a user manual for this is how you confront loss, but just 3 things that we need to keep in mind when we're facing loss. And so we're going to start at the very beginning. We're going to start in chapter 1, verse 1, if you're following along. So Ruth 1:1, I can invite you to read along with me. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and 2 sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion died, and Naomi was left without her 2 sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her 2 daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her 2 daughters-in-law, 'Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband.' Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud. And they said to her, 'We will go back with you to you and your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, Naomi said, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Naomi means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned home from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Well, there's a lot of sad stories in the Bible, but this opening chapter is probably a contender for one of the most depressing opening chapters of any book in the Bible. We have this family fleeing famine who moves from Israel to Moab, a neighboring country, during a time when Israel is in tension with its neighbors. And further, Moab has been a historic enemy of Israel, and so it makes for a very unlikely place to resettle, which just goes to show how bad the famine probably was. And so Naomi's husband dies. The sons marry Moabite women, which is considered scandalous in Israel. And after 10 years, her sons die as well. So Naomi decides to return to her country when she hears that God has provided food again, and she tries to dissuade her daughters-in-law from coming, but she only convinces one of them. And so, while Orpah turns back, who Oprah is named after, in case you were wondering, Ruth is resolute to stay with Naomi and adopt her land, her people, and her God. And she's essentially taking on a whole new identity while Naomi's returning to her old one. And the tragedy that these women are facing is deeper than most in our context can recognize. It's bad enough that they've both lost their husbands, and for Naomi, her children. But the setting of the story is a very patriarchal one in an agricultural society where women were dependent on men for their well-being. And so they inherited land through their husbands, which was then passed on to their sons. And what's more is, this is a society in which children were seen as security for you as you grew older. And so the expectation was, as you grew older, your children would take care of you. So not only are Naomi and Ruth facing the tragedy of death, but they've also lost their means of provision, their place, and their significance. And as this chapter concludes, the future is rather bleak, because Naomi's too old to marry, and Ruth, being a foreigner, is very unlikely to get married in Israel. And so what does Naomi do? She mourns. She laments. Hard. If there's one thing we can learn from Naomi about how to face loss, it's that we need to mourn our losses. Naomi doesn't rationalize her loss, and she doesn't pull punches with God either. When she returns, she still tells people, stop calling her Naomi or pleasant, but instead call me Mara or bitter. And then she talks about how bad God has treated her. The Lord has made her life bitter, made her empty, afflicted her. I don't know about you, but when I read this, I can almost hear all the unhelpful things a person might say to her. You know, people might try and maybe correct her theology. Say something like, no, God didn't do this. That's just life. Bad things happen in life. Or they might try and change her perspective and say something like, this is all part of God's plan. Or there's a reason for this. You'll see. Or maybe just try to get her to see the bright side. Something like, better to have loved and lost than never to have loved. I don't know. Something like that. Or perhaps someone in Naomi's position might tell themselves any number of those things just to try to soften the blow a little bit. And I think this can often be the case because we want people to feel better. That's natural. No one wants to suffer and no one wants to see people suffering. The problem is words seldom achieve that. I think perhaps the best thing words can do is acknowledge the pain of a situation. But I think another reason why it's so easy to say these things is that I think sometimes we think that faith means that we have to feel good about God or life, no matter what happens. And that if we don't, a lot of times we might think it's a sign of weakness or immaturity. I don't think that's biblical. Biblical faith, as I see it, is honest faith. And the truth is that Naomi's lament in this situation is actually a product of her faith. One commentator put it this way, that her use of the title Shaddai for God, which we translate in this passage as Almighty, just the use of that title shows faith in God's ability to nurture and sustain, even though she's using it in her complaint, as she's complaining about God. Have you ever run into a friend that was going through a tough time? Someone that just kind of, maybe you detected pain in their demeanor, but they won't tell you. You know, you might ask them, how are you? How are you doing? They might say something like, oh, I'm fine. You might raise an eyebrow. You sure? Yeah, I'm fine. Well, tornado just hit your house. You sure about that? Now, the truth is if they don't open up, it limits how much you can be there for them. That conversation's not going to get past I'm fine until the answer changes to I'm not fine and here's why. And that's kind of how it is with us and God. It's difficult to meet with God where we are if we lie to ourselves about where that place is. When we face loss, we need to tell God how we feel. Without feeling like we have to dress it up. Without feeling like we have to have the right words. And when we do that, it actually shows that we have faith that God can take it. And that God wants genuine relationship with us, not just the pretense of it. And if you're not comfortable doing that, if you're not comfortable, and not everybody is, but if you're not comfortable giving the unedited version of your emotions to God, if you're not comfortable with that, I suggest appropriating some scripture that kind of resonates with how you feel. Maybe take a psalm of lament, and about a third of the psalms are actually laments. Make that your prayer. When I find someone in a tough situation who's having trouble praying, I like to point them to Psalm 88 and suggest maybe make this your prayer if you don't know how to pray. And Psalm 88, it's a psalm that has no happy ending. It's just pain. Or maybe borrow Naomi's words. Lord, you've made my life bitter. You've made me empty. You've afflicted me. If that resonates with you, make that your prayer. But whatever method you decide, whether you want to appropriate scripture or whether you just want to let God have it, whatever method we decide, we need to be honest so that we can let God meet us in our pain. Biblical faith is honest faith. It doesn't try to soften the blow of our pain by looking for a silver lining or by rationalizing. It takes that pain, it takes our complaint, and it gives it to God. And if we're experiencing loss, we need to mourn our losses. And if we're near someone experiencing loss, then we need to mourn with them. The next thing this book shows us that we need to keep in mind in the midst of loss is that God provides in loss. Now, in order to understand the next part, we need a little background. We need to understand the practice of gleaning. And in this time, in the law, Israel's commanded that when they harvest, not to harvest the edges of their field and not to pick up what was dropped by the harvesters. That's to be left for the poor and the foreigners so that they can have something to eat. And that's going to provide context for what we see happen in the next chapter. So we're going to start again in the beginning of chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor.' And Naomi said to her, 'Go ahead, my daughter.' So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. 'The Lord be with you.' 'The Lord bless you,' they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of the harvesters, 'Who does that young woman belong to?' The overseer replied, 'She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi.' She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter.' So Boaz said to Ruth, 'My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled.' At this she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, 'Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?' Boaz replied, 'I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my lord,' she said. 'You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants.'" After this conversation, Boaz makes sure that she has plenty to eat at mealtime, even to the point where she has some left over. And then he instructs the harvesters to even pull some stalks out from the bundles they've already gathered to leave for her to glean. And so when Ruth returns, Naomi finds out that she's been gleaning in Boaz's field, and she says in verse 20, "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead," she added. "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." And as it turned out, Boaz had actually invited Ruth to glean throughout the rest of the harvest, and Naomi encourages her to do so and stay in his field. And so in this chapter, we see God orchestrating circumstances to provide for Ruth and Naomi, even in unexpected ways. We see God providing through Ruth, the foreigner, the Moabite, and yet heroine of the book, who's now gleaning for herself and Naomi. And she's the one who stuck with Naomi, even though she told her not to, showing her a love and a faithfulness that Israel's actually called to in their law. And we see that she's bold and determined by the overseer's report. And so Ruth decides to go and glean wherever she can, and it just so happens that the field that she ends up in is a wealthy relative of Naomi's late husband. And what's more, he's what they call a guardian redeemer, which in Israel was someone who could redeem property that had been sold by a relative who had fallen into poverty. And this is important because Ruth is in a very vulnerable position, and the possibility of being harmed or abused is very real, which is why Boaz reassures her, especially as a foreigner. And so God is providing both food and safety for Ruth and Naomi through Ruth's faithfulness and determination and Boaz's generosity. And his generosity isn't subtle either. In verse 17, we skipped over it, but in verse 17 it says, Ruth brought home about an ephah, which is far more than anyone could glean in a day. It's estimated that she brings home enough for her and Naomi to eat for about a week. God provides in a seemingly hopeless situation, sustaining, protecting Naomi and Ruth in the wake of their loss. But I also want to highlight how it happens. He does it through people. He orchestrated the circumstances, but he provides through people, namely Ruth and Boaz. And he still does it that way a lot of times. When people are experiencing loss in this church, God will use people to provide. I talked to a friend of mine who had gone through a painful divorce, and she told me that how devastated she was after it happened, and that she was in such a hard emotional place that she had trouble relating to people after it happened. But she told me something interesting. She said, the friendships that survived that season were the people who didn't stop calling and the people who didn't get frustrated when she didn't pick up. So her friends were continually there for her after the fact. That's often how God provides in the wake of loss, through the actions and the presence of people around them. If we're experiencing loss, this should encourage us to press in all the more to the community around us. And if we're around someone experiencing loss, it should encourage us to be that community that they can press into so that God can use us to provide for them. And that might be making a meal for them, just so that life is just that much easier for them. Or maybe calling them relentlessly, even if they don't pick up, just in case they need someone to talk to. Or checking in with them over coffee. And if you're not sure, if you're around someone facing daunting loss and you're not sure how to be there for them, just ask, hey, what do you need? What can I do? God provides in loss, but God also goes beyond provision. God can also redeem loss so that something new and good can come out of it. Let's take a look in chapter 3. It says, one day Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. So Ruth does what Naomi tells her, and she finds Boaz asleep on the threshing floor, probably after a harvest celebration. And so she lies at his feet and understandably startles him. And then he says to her in verse 9, who are you? He asked. I'm your servant Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of your family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. lie here until morning. What's happening here is essentially a marriage proposal by Ruth. And she appears to be adding another practice to the Redeemer's difficulties, if I can get technical one more time. In the law, it says that if a man dies without a child, his brother is to marry his widow so that she can have children. And there seems to be kind of a loose interpretation of this here, which might have been custom at the time, we're not sure. But Ruth appears to be anticipating being kind of a surrogate to provide a son for Naomi. And so she makes this proposal to Boaz, but Boaz is trying to act with integrity because he knows there's a closer relative who actually has the rights to redeeming. And so early in the morning, Ruth leaves before anyone can recognize her, and Boaz sends her off with even more grain. And then Naomi reassures her that Boaz is going to settle the issue that day. And what he does next is rather clever. He sets up a makeshift meeting that morning with the guardian redeemer, that's the closer relative, and the elders of the town, who often settled local legal matters in this setting. And so the following dialogue ensues, this time in chapter 4. It says in verse 3, "Then he said to the guardian redeemer, 'Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of those of these seated here, and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so, but if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line.' 'I will redeem it,' he said. Then Boaz said, 'On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property.' At this, the guardian redeemer said, 'Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it.'" So Boaz first brings up the issue of the land that Naomi's selling and the guardian redeemer has the rights to. And after the redeemer agrees to buy it, Boaz catches him off guard by saying that then this man has to marry Ruth. Oh, and by the way, she's a Moabite, which puts him off because she's a foreigner. And so there's that issue, but there's also the issue of perhaps whatever children result from this marriage, they're the ones who have the right to the property now. And so there's the issue that he might be left out the money that he actually paid for the property. And so it might have been a combination of those two factors that he backs out. And so Boaz buys the property, he marries Ruth, and they have a son. And the book concludes with Naomi caring for the child, but it tells us something significant. This time down in verse 16. It says, "Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." This initially might look like a footnote. Like, this is what happened, and it just so happened that this son was an ancestor of David. And the book concludes with David's genealogy. But the Hebrew audience of this book knows that name very well. This is David, as in King David, as in the king in Israel's history that all other kings are measured by. As in David, through whose line the Messiah comes from, who we know and worship as Jesus Christ. This son is more than just provision for Naomi. Through this son, both Naomi and Ruth are incorporated into the redemptive history of Israel. The next time we see Ruth's name in the Bible, it's in Jesus' genealogy in the Gospel of Matthew. These two widows were in a destitute state, just trying to survive, and somehow in the process, God takes their loss and through it incorporates them both into the line of royalty. The royalty, like King of Kings royalty. God can do things with our losses that we can't even imagine. And through our loss, we might see God move in ways that we wouldn't otherwise see. Now, that doesn't mean that our loss isn't hard. It doesn't mean that it's not sad. What it means is that God can and will work for our good through our losses if we follow him. Some of you know this, but this isn't exactly what I pictured myself doing a little over 10 years ago. I had other plans. I had a whole other career in mind. I got to college preparing for something completely different, and about halfway through, I found out that wasn't going to happen. The door got closed, and I kind of had this now what moment with God. Now what do I do? And it wasn't until that happened that I even considered going to seminary to train for ministry. But even after I made that decision, things happened way slower than I wanted them to. I thought I was going to graduate, knock it out, become a pastor, live happily ever after. I'll give you two guesses as to whether that happened. It didn't. What happened was, after college, and worked a job that I absolutely hated, only to be fired by the grace of God, and then work another one that was more tolerable, but I still wasn't crazy about it, all the while waiting for the circumstances to be right so that I could go back to school. But what was really difficult to see at the time was God was still working. Even in the wake of that loss, he was shaping me, teaching me, humbling me. And during a period where I wasn't even sure if I was even going to be able to go to seminary at all sometimes. And it took a long time before I could actually get to that point where I could actually go to school full time. And when it finally happened, it was one of the first times in my life where I felt like I was doing what I was made to do. And I could see, you know, hindsight is 20/20. Looking back, I could tell you that at the very least, school would have been a lot harder if God had not done that work. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't sting a little when I talk to someone who actually does what I wanted to do. You know, it doesn't mean that I don't have thoughts about what might have been. But I can tell you, what I can tell you is that the life I have now, it fits. It fits. And seminary is not a goal unto itself, at least not for most people. It's supposed to be a means for greater things. And so I still don't know what's ahead. But I can tell you where I'm at now, it fits. God somehow took the dream I lost and replaced it with something that I feel like I was made for. And even somehow used the loss of that dream to prepare me for what he had in mind. Let's have the band come back up. Now, I don't want us to get the impression that every story of loss has a happy ending in this life. The nature of loss, it simply doesn't allow for that. Even though Naomi and Ruth's losses are redeemed to a degree, they both lost their husbands. And for Naomi, she lost two children that didn't come back. What makes loss so difficult is that it's usually permanent on this side of things. But we need to remember where our hope lies. The book of Ruth ends with the beginning of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. It foreshadows a greater reality than just a son for Naomi. That's where our hope lies. God may do wonderful things, even with our loss, but ultimately, things are only going to be made completely right when Jesus returns and his kingdom comes in its fullness. And so before we respond to God, I encourage you, take a moment. Name your losses again. And if you wrote them down, take a look at them. And name them before God. Don't let them off the hook either. Tell God how you feel about them. Ask him to meet you where you are, wherever that place is. If you're struggling, ask him to restore hope that somehow he can work for good, even in these losses. I invite you to keep that conversation going as we respond to the Lord.